Okay, hello everyone. I'm Peng Cui from Media and Network Lab from the Tsinghua University. And thanks Jingdong for the invitation. And it's my honor to present our recent works on the network representation learning, revisiting the big data era. So now actually every day talk about big data, right? Big data actually is very challenging, we know, because the fact in the left, right? The data actually exponentially grow with the time. So the current computing technology, this actually imposed very serious challenge to the current computing technologies. But at the same time, actually we need to consider another fact. That is the computing power is also exponential grow with the time. So from this sense, it seems there is no big problem. Right, the data exponential grow, and also the computing power also exponential grow. But we argue that this is a fact only if the data is unlinked. So what if the data is linked? So let's think about this case. So now the provided computing power is still the exponentially grow with the time. But if we think that the data are fully connected, then the required computing power on this kind of data is exponential with the data scale, right? And if the data scale is exponentially grow with the time, then the required computing power is actually double exponential. So between the provided computing power and the required computing power, there is a very serious gap here. So we think that the real big data problem actually resides in the linked data, right? So data is linked in most of the time in real cases. For example, in social networks, people are linked to each other to form the social network, right? And for the biology networks, actually the genes are connected to each other to form a complex biology network. And even the images and videos we capture every day, actually they are connected. For example, some images may be taken at the same event, in the same event, at the same time, and are at the same place. So they will form the visual web, right? So here we can see that networks are natural representations for such kind of linked big data, right? So the network analytics, actually, we have done a lot of research on this topic, and we try to propose some method for some descriptive tasks like the node importance measurement, community detection, and network distance measurement, and also some predictive tasks like link prediction, node classification, or network evolution. And all of this technology actually have very vital impact on many real applications. However, the real adoption of this advanced network analytics in real industry is not very optimistic. We know that in China we have very large social network, the Tencent, the biggest social network company. They have billion scale social network, right? And in Taobao we have a very billion scale e-commerce network. But when I talk with the engineers and the researchers in Tencent and the Taobao, I found that they actually just use very simple or even heuristic rules to process the large graph, the large network they form. So I just told them that, hey, we have very advanced network analytics algorithm, and that can definitely improve your performance. They just say, hey, buddy, just first of all, run your algorithm on our billion scale network and give us a response with acceptable time. So actually, we know that the advanced network analytics algorithm cannot do that, right? So at that time, I just realized that the network today has grown to such a scale that no sophisticated network analytics is doable. Right? This is actually a very challenging problem to us. So what is the bottleneck? What's the bottleneck that caused this dilemma? So this is a network, and on the left we can see this is a natural the common representations that we use for research. Right? We often represent a network with a vertex set and an edge set here. So here we just find that the problem resides in the links. It's the link that bring us a lot of challenges and problems in processing these kind of networks. So here we can see that it is the link that bring to cause that the network analytics algorithms are often iterative or combinatorial. So here we can see that if we want to measure the importance of this node, then before that we need to know the importance of all the neighboring nodes, right? So then in this way, we need to traverse the whole network to calculate the node importance, right? So in this way, actually, the algorithm is iterative, right? And if you want to measure the distance between any two nodes, there are multipasses, right? So the measure is a combinatorial problem. So in this way, if we process this network in this way, then we will have a very high complexity. And the second one is because of the link that the nodes in the networks are actually coupling to each other. So we cannot very easily to parallel the network analytics in multiple servers, right? When we process one node, we need the data of other nodes, right? It's not easy to cut or to parallel this kind of calculation, right? And the third one is dependency. It's because of the link, the node and node are dependent to each other. So in the classical machine learning methods, actually most of them are both based on the vector space, right? In the vector space, we assume that the data sample are independent to each other so that we can have very solid and a very elegant solution. But for network, all of the nodes are dependent to each other. So the traditional machine learning methods cannot directly apply into the network analytics, right? So here we think that the problem actually arises from the links. Then we just ask ourselves, is this the only way that we represent a network, right? So we think that underlying each network, there is often a latent space, right? In the latent, for example, if two people form a social link, then there must be some social proximity in their latent space. They have similar social attributes. So underlying each network, there should be this kind of low-dimensional vector space. This low-dimensional vector space is the more intrinsic representation of a network. Network is just a reflection of this kind of vector space, right? So here the problem is, what we observed in this kind of network, can we embed this network back into this kind of low-dimensional embedding space, right? If we can do this, then the node in the network is still the node in the embedding space. But the link information, the link in the node, in the network, actually is replaced by the distance metric in the vector space, right? So in this way, if we can transform the network into this embedding space, it should be very easy to parallel the network analytics. And also we can apply classical machine learning methods to deal with network problems. Then our goal is to try to realize this kind of transformation. But the ultimate goal, ambitiously speaking, we want to replace the original network with embedding space in various network applications. That means we want to do all this kind of tasks, like node importance, community detection, and the link prediction, all this kind of tasks in this vector space, right? This is the ultimate goal of the network embedding. So how can we do that? So here we think that we need to set up two goals for network embedding. The first is the network embedding space should be able to reconstruct the original network, right? And the second one is the embedding space should be able to support network inference, right? This is the two goals of the network embedding. Actually, network embedding is not a very new topic. In the past, there have been some works on this topic, but most of them are just to target the first goal to reconstruct the original network. So matrix factorization here actually is a very commonly used method in this kind of works. And here we can represent each network with adjacency matrix, right? Adjacency matrix just to represent the network topology. And then after applying SVD on the adjacency matrix, actually we can get the embedding matrix of each node, right? So in this way, we can use the embedding space to reconstruct the adjacency matrix, then we can reconstruct the original network, right? But if we see the objective function of this kind of method, we will realize that this kind of work, actually, the goal is to find out an embedding space to overfit the network, just to try to reconstruct all of the observed links of the network. Then in this kind of overfitting space, actually, it's the network inference ability is seriously limited, right? Our goal is to overfit the network, not the inference on this kind of embedding space. So our work mainly target the second goal, just to try to support the network inference. So we call our work as network embedding 2.0. So here, in order to do that, we have two tasks. One is whether we can find an embedding space to reflect the network structure, right? To not just reconstructing the link, but also maintain the network structure in the embedding space. And the second one is whether we can find an embedding space, try to guarantee that the space can maintain network properties. For example, the transitivity of the networks, right? So actually in recent years, we have done some research, and I will just give you two examples. First is try to reflect the network structure. We know that in the network, very commonly used network structure information is the first order proximity. Actually, it's just a link, right, to tell whether two nodes are linked to each other, and also the second order proximity. The second order proximity, we can see that the nodes 5 and node 6, actually, they are not directly linked, but they have many common neighbors, right? So we can use a common number of common neighbors to represent their proximity here. So the problem is how to simultaneously incorporate the first order proximity and also the second order proximities in the embedding, right? So this is our target problem. So actually, in the previous work, there have been work that have demonstrated that if you want to learn a mapping function from the network space to the latent embedding space, then the function should be highly nonlinear because the network actually is very complex. You cannot use just a linear function to do this kind of mapping, right? So the F should be a highly nonlinear function. And also, in order to support the network inference, we need the mapping function can maintain the network structures like the first order and the second order proximity. So enlightened by this, we come out an idea that the deep learning model will know that it's very advantageous to process this kind of nonlinear mapping problem, right? So whether we can propose a deep model for network embedding, right? And at the same time, we can impose some constraint on the learning process to guarantee that the learned representation can preserve the network structure like the first order and also the second order proximities. But the challenges here is the first is that the deep model actually is designed for vector space data, right? It's usually used for images, videos, and text, and it can be easily or straightforwardly represented by vectors in the vector space. Right, so how can we use the deep model to process network, the relational data, right? So the second one is how can we preserve the first order and the second order structure information in this kind of deep learning, end-to-end deep learning solution. So in this year's KDD, we just have a paper that work on the deep model for structure preserving network embedding. Actually, in this work, it's basically based on the autoencoder structure. So here, you can see that for each node, we just use a neighborhood vector to represent a node, right? Then the autoencoder just try to learn a latent representations, and the latent representations can reconstruct the neighborhood vector. So this is a basic learning process. But in this way, if two nodes, they have similar neighborhood vector, then they will learn similar latent representations. So in this way, we can preserve the second order proximity of each node, of the nodes, right? And in order to maintain the maintain the first order proximity, we just impose a Laplacian eigenmaps on the representation layer. That means if two nodes that are directly linked, then we constrain that their learned representations should be similar to each other. So in this way, actually, the first order proximity can be guaranteed, right? So this model actually is very simple, not complex in the architecture, but the performance actually is very impressive. So here you can see that for the, we just attested the learned representations in various tasks, like network reconstruction, whether we can use the embedding space to reconstruct the network. So you can see that the SDNE, our method, actually can significantly outperform all of other embedding basis method, right? And also we test the representations in the link prediction to validate whether the embedding space can support network inference, right? We're just using the embedding space to predict the links in the future. So in the archive data, in the top 10,000 links, actually our accuracy is 100%, right? And in the block catalog data, actually our method can outperform all the baselines by at least 2 times. So that means that the deep learning methods is actually very useful to process this kind of nonlinear problem. And the structure information in the preserving actually is very essential for the network representation learning. So this is just one example, try to preserve the network structure in the network embedding space. And another example is try to maintain the network property. So among all of the properties of networks, I think the transitivity should be the most important, right? Because the transitivity actually guarantees that we can do some kind of network inference, right? So for example, in a network, if A and B has a link and B and C has a link, then it is more possible that A and C will have a link, right? So this is called transitivity in the networks. So let's see the embedding space. So in the embedding space, actually, there is also a rule that is triangle inequality, right? In the triangle inequality, if A is close to B, B is close to C, then A is relatively close to C, right? So it seems that they are very consistent to each other, right? But the real network data actually is very complex. That's far beyond our assumption. So here I just gave you an example. That's the directed graph. So in the directed graph, we can see that the transitivity is asymmetric, right? There is a link from A to B and B to C, then there will be possible a link from A to C, but not C to A. So the transitivity actually is asymmetric, right? But if we see the embedding space, the triangle inequality actually is symmetric. But the real transitivity phenomenon in the network is asymmetric. So there is a conflict here. So how to incorporate the asymmetric transitivity in the embedding space? So actually, this is a very challenging problem because the asymmetric transitivity will impose very serious challenge to all the existing methods. For example, if we just try to represent each node with a single vector, then given this graph, given this network, we will have A is similar to B in the embedding space, and B is similar with C in the embedding space. Then we will infer that A is similar to C, and C is similar to A, right? So in this way, asymmetric just a fail, right? And another example, if we just use two vectors, one source vector and one target vector to represent each node, then given this network, we will have source A is similar with target B, and the source B is similar to target C, right? So in this way, actually, we don't have any constraint on the source A to target C. So in the embedding space, we will not have this kind of result. So in this way, the transitivity fail, right? So after a long time of study and research, we just find out that the high order proximity in the networks actually can is an asymmetric transitivity metric. For example, if we calculate the CAS, just a weighted sum of passes between any two nodes, this is a measure. If we calculate the CAS measure for this network, we will get this kind of numbers. So we will see that A to C is 0.18, but from C to A is 0, right? So the high order proximity can maintain the asymmetric transitivity problem here, right? So a very straightforward solution is just this, right? We just represent the network with the high order proximity matrix to replace the adjacency matrix. Then we just apply SVD on this kind of matrix, right? So this is a very naive solution here. But the problem is the calculation of the high order proximities is not scalable. So for example, for CAS, it's n squared complexity. Right? So we cannot calculate the high order proximity for very large scale network, right? So after some study, we find that all the commonly used high order proximity, actually they have a general formulation. They can be transformed into a product of an inverse matrix and another matrix. You can see that the CAS measure, personalized the page rank, and also common neighbors, dynamic ADA. This kind of high order proximity, all of them can be transformed into this general form. And the mystery of this general form is we can decompose S without calculating S. We can decompose S by the combination of the results of SVD on MG matrix and ML matrix. So in this way, actually, this method can reduce the complexity to the linear with the H number and also have a very good theoretically guaranteed upper bound. Right, so this is our method. And after deriving this method, and we just do some experiments to see whether we can just reconstruct the high order proximities in the latent space. So here you can see that compared with the baselines, the high order proximities in our method, the error rate can be reduced more than 70%, more than 70%, very significant. And also, we just test the prediction, the inference ability of the embedding space in the real networks like the Sina Weibo and also the Twitter. And you can see that the prediction accuracy can be boosted by 2 to 4 times. So here, I just want to emphasize that these two methods, common neighbors and dynamic ADA, actually, they are implemented in the original network space. And our method is implemented in the embedding space. That means that in the embedding space, we can even get much better performance than the link prediction in the original network, right? So this is actually tell us that the embedding space actually have very powerful ability in the network inference. So here, I just want to summarize. The network data actually is undermined in the real applications, and the bottleneck actually is just the complexity and the scalability issue. So here we think that the fundamental solution is try to propose some new representation learning method for this kind of large-scale networks. And network embedding has been demonstrated to be a promising way, but actually it's still a long way to go from the network reconstruction to the structure preserving and to the property maintaining network embedding methods. So thank you. This is students and collaborators. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jindan, for your kind introduction. And good afternoon, everyone. My name is Toshi Yamasaki of the University of Tokyo. So today I would like to share our recent research activities on presentation analysis using the big multimedia data on the internet. So let me explain about myself a little bit more. I'm Toshi Yamasaki. I came from the University of Tokyo, and my main research field is multimedia and computer vision and pattern recognition. And our research team is interested in what we call attractiveness computing. So we are trying to the people get attracted to a specific person, to a specific service, or to a specific object, right? So we are now trying to analyze why and how we get attracted. And if we can know that, well, we can predict the attractiveness of the unknown, or we can even enhance the attractiveness. So right now we are working on, for example, the presentation analysis or fashion image analysis, social popularity analysis, or human attractiveness, or the real estate tech, or photo shooting in terms of taking the attractive photos. So today I would like to focus on this part, the presentation analysis. So I would like to ask you, are you good at doing presentations? Or do you have confidence in your presentation? Well, I guess a lot of people, not you, but ordinary people would say no in most cases. So that's why we can find a lot of textbooks on how to make your presentations better. But, well, in most cases, it's hard to really understand from just by reading the textbooks. So how about doing the, how about practicing by yourself? No, it doesn't make sense because there's no feedback. So there's no chance for you to improve your presentation skill. So we usually have rehearsals in front of your friends or colleagues, but nobody is freely available, so we end up with doing the rehearsal only once or twice. So I have to say that even now, the obtaining the good presentation skills is still a very difficult problem. So we are now trying to solve this problem. And in the next slide, please watch one certain video, which is taken from the TED Talk.
Sadly, neurological disorders such as Parkinson's disease gradually destroy this extraordinary ability, as it is doing to my friend Jan Stripling, who was a virtuoso ballet dancer in his time. So great progress in treatment has been made over the years. However, there are 6.3 million people worldwide who have the disease, and they have to live with incurable weakness, tremor, rigidity, and the other symptoms that go along with the disease. So what we need are objective tools to detect the disease before it's too late. We need to be able to measure progression objectively. From the sound, we can actually track the vocal fold position as it vibrates. And just as the limbs are affected in Parkinson's, so too are the vocal organs. So in the bottom trace, you can see an example of irregular vocal fold tremor. We see all the same symptoms. We see vocal tremor, weakness, and rigidity.
Okay, because of the time limitation, I cannot show you the whole video. But how did you feel about this presentation? What did you think? Was it good or bad? Well, because this video is uploaded to TED Talk, it's kind of the social network service for presentation. So the viewers of this presentation can actually do voting how they felt about this presentation. So they already have 14 predefined impression labels, such as ingenious, persuasive, fascinating, blah, blah, blah. And we can vote. We can tell the system how we felt about this presentation. So we already know the ground truth. So we already know how the people in the world felt about this presentation. And this is the result. The table on the left is the real data taken from the TED. So the people in the world who watched this video thought this presentation was ingenious, inspiring, persuasive, informative, and fascinating, and jaw-dropping. And the figure on the right are the result of our system, which I will talk about later in the following slides. So our system predicted that this presentation would invoke the impressions such as informative, persuasive, fascinating, jaw-dropping, and ingenious. So as you can see, the predicted impressions are almost the same as the ground truth. So again, our research team is now doing the presentation analysis, focusing on what makes the presentation more attractive or impressive, or what impressions do the listeners would have. But actually, after starting the project, we realized that this is really a tough problem because the presentation is a mixture of a lot of different type of modalities. For example, the slides are images, and the content of my speech is a document. And how I speak is acoustic information. And of course, the gesture matters, which is activity, right? So we have to consider a lot of different parameters to do the presentation analysis. And I don't want to go to the technical detail in today's presentations, but as a summary, we employ three kinds of features. One is content feature, about what the speaker is talking about, and a grammatical feature, how much the speaker is, and a sound feature, how the speaker is talking. And there are actually two technically challenging problems. One is how to combine the multiple kinds of features. So in this case, we have three kinds of features. So we want to combine them effectively and efficiently. And the second problem is how to consider the correlation between inflation labels. So we try to predict not only whether the presentation is bad or poor, but we now try to predict the 14 impressions, the yes or no's for 14 impressions. So we have to consider the correlation or occurrence between the labels. And our system currently can achieve 93.3% of accuracy for 14 kinds of impression that I will introduce later. And a technical background here, well, the trick is here. We try to solve this problem as a joint optimization problem of the multi-label classification problem and multi-feature fusion problem. So there's one equation. So we tried to formulate these two problems into a single Markov random field energy minimization problem. So this equation looks a little bit complicated, but you can forget about it. There are only three kinds of terms. The first one is a unary term, which corresponds to the decisions of the classifiers. So if we consider only the first term, we don't consider the correlation between the labels, and we don't consider the multi-features. The simplest one. And the second term is the intra-layer pairwise term, which corresponds to the correlation between the different label types. And the third one is the correlations between the different feature types. So by minimizing this equation, we can get what type of impressions would be the best combination for a given presentation. And even though this equation seems a little bit complicated, we can easily get the global minimum by using a QPBO, which is a family of graph cuts. And we applied our system to 1,600 TED Talks. Here are some results. The y-axis is the prediction accuracy, and x-axis is the 14 impressions plus average. Although you can find a lot of bars here, but I would like you to focus only on this, the rightmost red bar. So in our system can achieve 93.3% of accuracy for predicting the impression labels for the TED Talks. And we also try to apply our system to unknown presentations. So for this time, we applied our system to the presentation of the previous and current CEOs of the Microsoft. So please, let's have a look.
Well, good morning. It's great to be here. I haven't been here for over 5 years, so it's great to see the way this event has grown. And I think it's fair to say that we're in a golden age of computer science. The original vision of Microsoft, that we had a dream about what software could do if we had infinite computing and infinite storage, that almost is our reality today. And so it's amazing for me to see how that's being applied, whether it's user interface with vision, speech, pen, with modeling in rich data areas, with machine learning. And it really seems like that idea.
Okay, so the Bill Gates tended to be very aggressive in his younger age, but now he's very matured and do a very good presentation. And our system predicted that the audience would have the impressions such as informative, persuasive, jaw-dropping, and courageous, only positive impressions. How about Steve Ballmer, the second CEO?
Well, it's sure a pleasure and an honor for me to have a chance to spend a few minutes with you. We had a chance to lay out a lot of what we wanted to talk about today in terms of news with Windows, with Windows Server, and with Windows Azure. What I'd like to do is just give you a little...
Okay, he's more energetic. And, well, in this case, our system said that, well, there would be some positive impressions, but as then some other negative impressions as well. And how about the current CEO, Satya Nadella?
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Build 2016. It's fantastic to be back here in San Francisco. Welcome to everyone here with us, as well as everyone joining us on the web. You know, for me, it feels like I've marked all my adult life with Microsoft Developer Conferences. In fact, when I think about even the birth of my children, I think about the various platform eras.
Okay, so our system predicted both positive and negative impressions for this impression. Well, let me compare the three presentations. Do you agree with it? So, well, these talks are not TED Talks. Well, so we don't know the ground truth. We need to ask the crowd workers, for example, to evaluate their presentations. But, well, it seems that the bill give only the positive impressions. And, well, actually, Steve and Satya would give the same impression. So even though the characters, the personalities of them are totally different from each other, our system say that their presentation would give a similar type of impressions because I guess they tend to have they tend to use the similar keywords. And Bill is the champion or king of the presentation. And of course, our system can be applied not only to the presentation analysis, but also the lectures in the universities, or the TV shopping, or e-commerce on the internet, because we have the photos and the presentation about the product, right? And of course, the sales, and even the job interview. And we are now trying to apply our system to finding partners, so the matching, because defining partners is kind of self-promotion, self-presentation to the counterpart, right? And, well, this is the joint work with a lot of Microsoft researchers, and I also had a chance to collaborate with other researchers in universities through the collaboration with the Microsoft people. And we also would like to thank the Microsoft for supporting us technically and financially. Okay, that's pretty much it. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Anyway, I'm Le Xinxie from Australian National University. My group have spent the past few years understanding how viral videos went viral. And I hope I will be able to convince you that we have a unique insight there. So here's the type of data and questions we're interested in answering. How does popularity evolve and what makes things viral? What makes things keep being viral? For example, here are two example YouTube videos. Most of you probably have seen the statistics tab under each video, which gives you either cumulative or daily trace of number of views things received. So here's a TED Talk that received the initial peak of attention and then the attention died down, except several like small comebacks. And here for the Brandenburg Concerto, after almost 400 years, it has been receiving like sustained attention up until now. And you wonder what makes videos kind of get attention one way versus some other way. So in the rest of this 20 minutes, I'm going to talk to you about our measurement study that we conducted about 2 years ago to understand at a large scale to what extent are each of these phenomena prevalent, right? And then we propose a new model that links popularity, perceived popularity to external promotions. Our take-home message is basically popularity is not just an intrinsic property of the piece of content, but more as a continuous interaction between external discussions to something and its intrinsic properties, as we will elaborate. And we can use such a model to explain what distinguishes the most popular videos versus the least popular, what videos are promotable and not promotable. And at the end, we talk about several predictions problems we tackle using this as well. So just to get started, 2 years ago, we crawled an old video data set. We call them the tweeted video from 2009. This is from a Stanford tweet dump over 2 months. After about more than four years, 172,000 of them are still online. Here's a breakdown of the videos over about a dozen categories. Over several data sets we looked at, music video always is the largest category. They take up about a quarter to a third of the data set. And then there is a spread over a handful of categories. The top ones are always related to entertainment, right? So these videos gives us a unique longitudinal view into how popularity evolves over more than 2 years. And here is a picture, a snapshot of this view. So we took these 172,000 videos, sorted them according to how much views they got when they were 5 days old, 5 days after their upload to YouTube. And we broke this into 20 bins, 5% each bin. Each bin has more than 8,000 videos. So as we can see, in the middle, there is a long continuity. So basically, each of these 8,000 videos have almost the same view in the sense they are within 1.3x of each other. So we animate this over time. So from 5 days, here's the picture up until 790 days. And or actually 900 days, 3 years. So if we overlay the picture of 5 to 900 days, we can see that uniformly the videos in the middle have gained two orders of magnitude in terms of popularity. This is another sort of observation in the rich get richer phenomena, right? And what stands out is only the top 5% or less videos that has like a larger spread of almost three orders of magnitude. These are the viral ones that we like tend to notice, and the media tend to notice, and the popular press tend to talk about. All right, and here is another view to this large scale data set that breaks down the videos evolution by category. So on your left, there's news videos broken down by these, again, 20 bins, and the y-axis are counts. So at 5 days, news videos are initially tend to be popular. This is unsurprising because they were new, and if we animate this, as time goes by, news videos tend to lose popularity in general, right? You may say this is not surprising, but look at what happens with music. At 5 days, they are bottom heavy, right? And if we animate this, music videos are slowly climbing up in popularity at the expense of other videos such as news. And you may wonder what leads to this kind of behavior. So before us, the prevalent sort of theory in explaining how popularity evolves are in exogenous shock versus endogenous growth, where the first type is, suppose there's a hurricane or tsunami happens in the external world. This affects how people behave in different parts of the world at the same time. People all go online and look up a term such as tsunami, and this leads to a sharp rise and a slow power law decay. The second kind of behavior is word of mouth diffusion or endogenous growth within a network. For example, if a Harry Potter movie is going to come out again, the word will slowly propagate through word of mouth. It peaks until it actually came out, and then there is another power law decay. So The authors back in 2008 have shown these on small curated data sets. In our large scale measurements, we indeed see some of the popularity evolution conforms with these two prototypical behavior. That's encouraging, but that's not enough. So in our measurement study published last year, we've looked at a large number, well, 172,000 videos, and then used these generalized power law curves to describe their evolution. We not only use this exogenous versus endogenous dichotomy, we also basically segment the popularity into power law-shaped phases. And this can basically explain some of the complex popularity we have seen, such as this gymnastic video, or something that apparently has an annual cycle. And the beauty of that system is it's a computationally tractable system, solvable in about quadratic time, and we summarize all the popularity evolution in four simple shapes. They are either convex or concave, they are either increasing or decreasing. So that was nice. I'm going to skip what we did with the phases and directly ask the next question about what leads to these apparently complicated popularity phases. The key to answering this question is to remember that we actually has a unique data set that intersects tweeting behavior and YouTube popularity. So we basically would like to explain the observed popularity with how much people are talking about a video and when. In order to do this, we need actually a temporal aligned tweeted video data set. So this is another effort about 2 years ago. Over a 6 month period, we have about 1 billion tweets and 81 million videos. So we basically observe each tweet about every single video. We would like to model three intuitive dimensions in this popularity evolution in that what are the network effects within the implicit social network? What are the system memory? Is something that news that it should be forgotten faster than, say, Brandenburg Concerto? And then some notion of inherent content quality, whether it's Gangnam Style or, say, My Cat video that nobody cares about. So one, our key for linking the endogenous popularity propagation with the external discussions goes back to the prime process literature, or as many of you would have remembered, Poisson process from textbooks long time ago, right? So existing literature about self-exciting prime processes are basically says one viewing event triggers another viewing event with a time decaying probability phi. What most of the current work does not model is in the presence of continuous stimulus from the outside world, what do we observe, right? So in terms of the memory kernel phi, there are several key factors. Content virality is a scalar that gets estimated for each video. Same with user influence warping factor and memory, basically how fast the content decays, right? How people forget something. Moreover, what this self-excited prime process models is a branching structure in that one parent event triggers children events, which in turn triggers other offspring events. So this is the starting point of our modeling work. We also realized that for data such as YouTube, this kind of data is neither available nor scalable, because estimation of this process is at least quadratic, and when we are talking about millions of views, this could be a nightmare. And plus, if you're a website, you don't want to give out individual viewing behavior data, right? So what we did is we applied a bag of tricks in stochastic calculus and arrived at what we call a Hawkes intensity process. That basically takes Hawkes process and takes the expectation over the stochastic history we observe. Remember, that's a random number of events at random times, so it's a little tricky there. But after we take care of that, we basically have an integral equation that explains the observed popularity volume CT with its own history. It's a convolution between its own history and the memory kernel, power law memory kernel, with an additive term for the external stimulus that gets folded in and in turn influences every single value of the subsequent popularity series. So that's a busy equation. We're going to understand it more over the next three slides. Computationally, this is what we did. Given this equation, we discretize it over time and estimate. So basically, the system takes the red series, which is the volume of discussions over time, and tries to explain the green series, which is the volume of views over time. This is a nonlinear optimization problem. So after about 500,000 CPU hours on the national supercomputer in Australia, we basically find fits like that for the large collection. What we're pleased to see is that despite that these popularity history are highly nonlinear and like irregular, we are able to find pretty good fits, right? Just to look at the same model from yet another different angle. So those of you who have a linear systems background may notice that this is actually a linear time invariant system. What it means is that the response of a video to external promotions is entirely determined by what its response is to one unit of external promotion, such as, well, delta T here. And if we take this impulse response and basically scale it with the volume of impulse at every time step and shift it correspondingly and add them together, we get back the total response. So what this allows us to do, this basically describes what we just said, is to quantify the amount of return on investment in promotions using the area under this impulse response function A. Right, that's an important quantity because we're going to use it in the next few slides. X-axis is the A we just talked about, return on investment on each tweet. You can think of it like that. Y-axis is the mu parameter, basically sensitivity, the scalar in front of external promotions. So here are four example videos. V1 and V2 are placed on the same spot, almost the same spot on this two-dimensional map. Means they will respond to promotions more or less the same way. Here they are showing different colors because V1 was way more popular than V2, where V1 was a gaming video that received three times as much promotions as V2. If we compare across the axes, we can see V3, actually a mathematics video, is similarly endogenously responsive, but it's less sensitive to promotions. So at the same amount of promotion, it's actually less popular than V1. So the same goes for V4. So that's for explaining how individual videos got where they are, and if we put the same amount of promotions in V2, we will get it to the same popularity in V1, right? So in terms of collections of videos, here are density maps on the same two-dimensional map for all film animation videos. So here are all the film trailers and so on. These are the top 5% film trailers. We can see the top 5% are not inherently more responsive, but they are more sensitive to promotions. If we look at gaming videos, on the other hand, it's slightly different story. So the most popular gaming videos tend to be shifted to the top right, meaning they are both more responsive and also more sensitive to promotions. Moreover, if we zoom out on this map, we are able to basically pinpoint videos who will not respond to promotions. For example, in this red circle highlights these video blogs that have basically mu times A of less than 1 in 1,000. Basically, for every tweet I give, the expected number of views I get back is less than 0.001. So that's bad. And here is the example of a teenager talking about how to make pizza. And if you try to promote this, you won't succeed. So another use, well, we can, coins have two sides, is that we could use this to identify videos that are potentially popular but have not yet done so. So here is the familiar popularity scale, except we still group video in 20 bins by their popularity at 1 year. And we on the y-axis, we plot their popularity at 6 months. So the videos in the circle were actually among the least popular in 6 months, but they become among the most popular in 1 year. So one would wonder, okay, what are they, what they did, right? So here's an example of videos, one video. This was actually talking about a rare neurological disease. It wasn't very popular in the first 90 days. According to our model, it has a high mu over 100 and a really high endogenous response factor of 10 to the power of 72. So in the next 30 days, it received some mentions, and then indeed the number of views blew up. It gained about 4 million views. So great, this model is useful for identifying these potential black swans that will become really popular. And we did also tested this model in terms of forecasting how many views some videos will get given promotion. And this Hawk's intensity model basically outperformed alternatives, state-of-the-art alternatives. There are various multi-linear regression. So just to conclude on a sort of literature review note. A lot of models in the literature are trying to tackle popularity promotion. We see a divide between generative models, such as our other work published this year, using point processes and paying some other people have also published on this space, and also feature-driven ones where people have taken the behavioral history and summarize them into features, and then the goal is to predict how many views. So we can bridge these two views by actually adding a predictive layer on top of the generative models and do better in both. So this is our paper published 2 weeks ago at CIKM. We also show that if we use the best of both worlds, we can do even better. In summary, I've talked to you about understanding popularity with a large-scale measurement on longitudinal popularity history. We've proposed a new model called the Hawk's intensity model to link volumes of popularity to the continuous influence of external promotions. We also bridge the problem and methods space in terms of predicting popularity. And if you're interested, check out our lab webpage with all the paper and code.